for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 599 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, comics creator Wells Thompson is back, and he's talking about his new book with Rachel Distler called The Catskin and the Rose, which is now being supported on Kickstarter. It's described as a 68-page adventure romance comic about discovering love in unexpected places, making sacrifices, and fighting for what's important in your life. It focuses on Iselda, who has trained her entire life for this moment, and Camille, the foreigner standing in her way. We talk about how this book came to be, delve into the characters, and talk about what else Wells is up to in the coming months. This Kickstarter will conclude on Thursday, August 10 at 12 noon Eastern Daylight Time, so be sure to support it once you listen to this fun conversation. Don't miss this excellent tale of two legendary duelists fighting to the death in a tournament when they catch feelings while crossing swords. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. The Catskin and the Rose is a graphic novella about two legendary duelists who fight to the death in a tournament but catch feelings while crossing swords. And today I'm talking with comic writer and critic co-author Wells Thompson. Welcome back to the podcast. How's it going, Wells?
It's going good. How are you doing?
Good to talk with you. We were talking before we started to record. Catskin and the Rose is doing very well on Kickstarter now. We're recording this a little early. And people always get mad at me because I never say this soon enough. This project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Thursday, August 10 at 12 noon Eastern Daylight Time. And as we're talking, your goal of $10,000 is right in the mirror. You can see this coming right at you. It's a 68-page adventure romance comic about discovering love in unexpected places, making sacrifices, and fighting for what's important in your life. I don't know what the word sapphic means. It's an incredibly sapphic graphic novel that features...
Sapphic is a Greek word for women loving women. Lesbian would be the... Which is also a Greek word, but...
Okay, all righty. So, let's see. Think Princess Bride meets Revolutionary Girl Utena. And I probably just fractured that last name. But I know Princess Bride, but I don't know the other, so.
It's an anime from, I want to say, the 90s, maybe the 80s. Okay. But it's, yeah, it falls again into that category.
Does this have an anime feel to it?
I would say Rachel's art has some notes of, like, a manga aesthetic. Not, like, fully. I think there's a lot of Western influence in there as well, but there's definitely a touch of that.
Okay. Because when it comes to anime, I for a while dipped my toe into the water, and I read some anime for a while. There was a book called My the Psychic Girl that I read, and every time I tell somebody who apparently knows anime, they say, I never heard of that.
Yeah.
So it was about a young girl with psychic powers and stuff like that. And I read that all the way through the end. There was like a couple hundred, I think, chapters to it. But I have to say, I got turned off of anime when I watched there was a story of a guy who got turned into a bear or something, and he was working in a china shop. And I kept watching this bear walk around behind the china. I was going, why doesn't he start wrecking things? You know, he's a great big bear, so I couldn't figure it out. So anyway.
There's a certain level of absurdity, for sure, in a lot of anime that, it takes a lot of suspension and disbelief to kind of get over. But So yeah, it's not for everyone. I can totally see that.
Well, yeah,
and it's not like I'm not the biggest, like I don't seek out a lot of anime. There's definitely some that I really like. There's some that I grew up with that I really, will vouch for, but I also totally understand why the style doesn't work for some people.
So did the anime influence the script and the story?
I don't think so. I think more I was influenced by, like, again, kind of like romance and adventure tropes was like really the thing that sort of got me going with this book, I wouldn't say like there was any one property that really stuck in my mind as I was writing it. It was more like, what does the story want to do? What do these characters want to do? And the more I explored it, the more it felt that kind of like Princess Bride, over the top sort of adventure feel.
So how long have you been working on the script for this?
I started writing right after the Frankenstein, the Unconquered number 2 Kickstarters finished. So in October, November of last year. And I wrote the first script in about, or the first draft of the script in about 5 days. 5 to 7 days. I might have taken a day or two off, but yeah, it just kind of poured out of me. I was really excited and energized about the idea and sort of wanted to make it, you know, as quickly as possible, which of course in comics terms is still like months and months of work to get that into something, you know, physical. So we've been working on it for, you know, better part of a year. We've been exchanging ideas and figuring out when the best time to debut it is. We're finally at a point where we're ready to show everyone and get it out the door.
So Rachel Distler, she's the artist on this. How did you meet Rachel?
I met her through some acquaintances on Twitter. That's most of the... especially when Twitter was, usable. It was a really good way of meeting with independent artists and getting to know the independent comics community. Britt Fisher, who is a really talented writer and one of the editors behind Color of Always and Sharp Wit and the Company of Women, I reached out to him because I had like basically a 2-page fan comic that I was like, I can't do anything with this really, but I still want it made. And I would like, you know, I think the best thing it can do is I can maybe shove it out onto the internet and maybe get some likes, maybe get some followers. Maybe it'll help, you know, make me a little bit more aware or, visible in the space. And I was like, here's the project. Do you know anyone who'd be good for it? And he gave me 4 or 5 names. One of them was Rachel. And I really liked her work. Reached out to her by happenstance, by luck. She was free to do it. And we really enjoyed working together. So when I had the idea for this script, I came to her and I was like, all right, this is a little bit weird. Because at this point, I actually hadn't written the script yet. I just kind of had the idea for it. And I knew I wanted it to be like a one shot. And I said, it'll probably be like 32 to 48 pages. You know, would you be down to draw something like that? And she was like, yeah, I think that would be good. And then, a week later I got back to her and I was like, so it's 64. And then they eventually grew into 68. Mm-hmm. So sorry about that. She was like, nah, you're absolutely. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just sort of curious because the other books that I've read of yours, this is the first time I think I've seen a queer indie comic. Was there a reason why you went here this time?
Well, it's not the first queer relationship I've written. In Mechaton, Hex is a non-binary. Leah is, I think, canonically bi. But they're in a queer relationship. And I have, stories and a novel even that features it. It's just, it's, First of all, I find writing what I, you know and what I am, like, what I have, like, personally lived, very boring, because, like, all my life, you know, I've read about protagonists that look and sound and act like me, that are straight white dudes. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's the stuff of, you know, I've been reading that since I was in middle school. It's that's Gatsby, that's, you know, Hemingway, that's every writer that we were forced to read, whether we liked it or not, in high school and in college. That was sort of the whole deal. So I just got to a point where I was very bored with writing that dynamic. And as it happens, I am fairly intimately familiar with sapphic relationships, because almost all of my friends are gay women. I don't know why that's the case. It just happens to be. And including my wife is bisexual and very loud in terms of her affection for women. And so there's plenty of material to work with, both in my personal relationship and through all of my friends. And I grew up around queer people, so it's, even at a young age, it was very familiar to me, even if I myself am not queer. So yeah, writing that dynamic, obviously you want to be as respectful as possible, but it wasn't like I was stepping very far outside my wheelhouse to do it.
Okay, that's good, because I always ask people, you know, because when I talk to a Caucasian male who's writing a person who is more diverse, shall we say. Sure. I always ask, how did you know how to write that? And usually it takes research, but you were living the research, so you didn't have to worry so much about that.
And yeah, and you always want to, you know, and that was part of the reason why I brought, you know, Rachel in specific in, and Keila, who is the letterer on this, and Krista Herreiter, who is the editor. I wanted a bunch of queer women and non-binary folk on the book, in part to be able to catch if I was doing something, you know, insensitive, or if something didn't work from their perspective, from their lived experience. And having those eyes on it and having those voices on it just makes it, you know, makes it richer, makes it more believable. So there were several kind of safety nets involved with doing that.
Did they point out something that they thought you should do a different way?
No. I Rachel did have some story notes, but it wasn't like, you're getting these, you know, you're getting this wrong, or this isn't how, you know, this would develop, or anything like that. For the most part, it was just like, hey, it would be cool if we added if we change locations here so that we could add a more dynamic, like, fight choreography. And I was like, cool, yeah, let's do that. So yeah, it was a very easy collaborative process, I'll say.
And if people want to see samples of the artwork, they can go to the Kickstarter, and under the story, there's the two covers and several samples of the pages. So that's good. So let's dive into the characters.
Absolutely.
You came up with some interesting names for things. Iselda is the first one that's listed under characters. She's a cat.
She's our point of view character, and she is, like, impoverished, a part of a lower caste of this society that we find ourselves in. This kingdom. And this is a really, like, stratified society. You're pretty locked in. You don't have a lot of mobility. The kind of one big exception to that is there's this tournament that's held, you know, infrequently, whenever a member of the royal family comes of age, and the winner of that tournament, this sword fighting tournament, will marry into the royal family. Iselda is a really skilled sword fighter, and so she enters thinking that this is her, like, one way of getting out. And she's one of the finalists. It's her and our other character, Camille, and they're fighting against each other to essentially escape their lives of squalor.
Mm-hmm. Now, it says here on the Kickstarter page is that Zelda managed to get her hands on a sword and used it to support herself through the years, honing her skill and cutting down the competition. When the 17th Tournament of Ascension was announced, she was ready to seize the opportunity. She's cut down every fighter in her path and stands now as a finalist. With only one opponent left, this will be child's play. The moment you say that, you're in trouble. So,
which I think in the next paragraph I go on to say, she's confident to the point of arrogance. Like,
yes.
And that's sort of a defense mechanism. Like, that's her taking being called, you know, dirty names and slang and put down as, you know, as someone who's nearly subhuman, and just channeling that into, actually, I'm the best out there and no one can even approach me. That's how she kind of copes with that in her life.
She fights in a flowing, almost dancer-like style with an endurance that tires out her opponents before she moves in for the kill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who is the inspiration for Zelda? Is she based on anybody you know? Is she a product of your imagination? Where's she from?
I think the visual design started with, if you played The Legend of Zelda, the Gerudo was sort of the starting point for the kingdom that we're in and for, the design of the character and the weaponry. But just like a desert faring, people, specifically in that game, it's a group of thieves, a group of exclusively women, who are thieves who live in this compound. And they, are incredible. They're like late game enemies. They're incredibly formidable. And that stuck with me. That was one of my favorite games as a kid. And that design has always sort of stuck with me, as well as the music, because it absolutely rocks. So that's been playing in my head for 20 some odd years. But from then, it just kind of came out to, I wouldn't say there's like a single point of inspiration of like, that I think about when I think of a Zelda to compare to. It was just, what kind of person would, you know, this society produce, and what, how would she cope with everything, and how would she act, you know, how would she talk? And the more I built on that, the more she kind of presented herself, in the writing. So,
'cause she's a ginger.
Yeah. Red hair.
Mm-hmm. She's red haired. And of course, red haired.
I'm trying to remember if that was my idea, if that was Rachel's idea, either way.
Because it stands out. I mean, you know, dark-haired women always kind of fade into the background. Blondes and red-haireds always seem to step forward. Now, as always in your writing, I'm always intrigued by the names of things. Mm-hmm. Her name is Zelda, and she's a cat skin.
Yeah.
Lowest caste in the kingdom of Baidun. Is it
Baidun?
Baidun.
Yeah.
A cat skin. The lowest caste. Where did the name for that come from? I'm just sort of curious.
I don't think I explain it in the story, but I think the idea was that this is a group of people so poor that if they want, like, to find clothing, they need to skin a cat for it.
Okay.
So yeah, so it's just got that, like, just there's something visceral there, and it feels a little derogatory, and it was sort of something that came as a happy accident to, like, you know, what can I say that's going to twist the knife a little bit in this character, and sort of the lore got born out of that. Was I named it that, and then I was like, oh, that's interesting. Where do we go from there?
So the name came before the skin.
Yeah, I'm I'd like to say that I, like, do, you know, that I'm a Robert Eggers, and I do, you know, ridiculous amounts of research before I ever put pen to page, but at least half the time I'm just naming stuff and then kind of backfilling. Well, where does that name come from? And how does that, you know, make the story, how does that make the environment and story richer? And just as often it works as well. So this I didn't feel is a story that you needed to do a ton of research in. It's because it is fantasy and it is intentionally set in nowhere like specific, nowhere in the real world, nowhere specific. There are cultural notes and touchstones and like the architecture is very like Moroccan and Indian and Lebanese inspired, like lower Mediterranean inspired. But we weren't pulling from like one specific culture for Baidu. We were just sort of creating some texture and trying to give it a feel that's unique in terms of like your typical sword fantasy, you know, medieval fantasy type of thing. It's easy to do castles. It's easy to do gray castles all over the place. And like those stories are great and I can look at a castle all day long, but I wanted to give it a little bit of a unique feel.
Mm-hmm. Like when some writers, and I happen to know one who, when he writes a character, he likes to develop 100 years of the history of the family and stuff like that. And it never all gets in the story, but he can, you know, pick and choose things out of that to introduce into the story. Did you, because this is the lowest cast.
Right. I typically do the opposite. I don't really think about what, you know, sometimes that is really helpful for sure. When you have those little details, in the background, you can go, oh, I can pull from that at this moment. Again, just as often, not, I think of myself as very lazy. I don't think that comes through in the writing. But I, you know, if I refer to someone's, you know, family, usually that's because I sit and I go, oh wait, okay, what would their family have been like? And I'm deciding in that moment and sort of, you know, figuring out how it works best with what I've already presented and what I've already done. And most of the time it works pretty well, to kind of integrate it in one piece at a time like that.
Some writers that works really well for, there's other writers, I liken it to going on a trip in a car. Sometimes you get in the car and you just sort of drive around and, you know, and see what's going on in the neighborhood and stuff like that. Whenever I move somewhere, I always do that. I get in the car and I drive around just to see what's in the neighborhood, but what's around. Other times I want to get to a destination. And if I know what the destination is, the journey is a lot more specific and stuff like that. So I guess it just depends on the writer sometimes. And you probably vary it up depending on the story you're telling.
Oh, yeah, it definitely depends on the story. There's one that I've written. You know, whether or not it becomes anything, I don't know. But that was a lot more historical and a lot more centered and rooted in, like, function in it takes place on a whaling ship, so I had to learn a lot about sailing and whaling vessels and how they're different from, you know, other kinds of ships and what that time period was like, what they ate, how they spoke, you know, how who would have been involved in a ship like that, what the positions would have been. And that was a lot more, you know, bottom up. You know, I knew what I wanted the story to be overall, but I had to do the research. And the more research I did, the richer the world became, because suddenly I could be like, oh, I can fit that into this moment. You know, I can, the reason that this character does X is because of Y part of his backstory, which makes sense, you know, because of this time period. There are definitely a lot of scripts that do like that. This one was probably a lot more fast and loose.
It depends, you know. I guess it depends completely on the story and the thing you're trying to tell.
I'll say Frankenstein the Unconquered is almost entirely on the fly. Like at this point, we've sort of written enough that we have a general idea of the geography, but we would never draw a map or anything. Like we've just named a couple of locations and like sort of built a lore out of whole cloth, just from our love of the characters and the environment and the references that we're pulling from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a pretty good. Now let's talk about the other character.
Sure.
Camille, listed here, it says, is a foreigner having traveled hundreds of miles to participate in the tournament and win her fortune. Having grown up in squalor, Camille dreams of stability, luxury, and peace, but isn't afraid to get her hands dirty to get there. She fought hard to earn her way here, and now she's just a swift cut away from the life she's always dreamed of. What could go wrong? That's another question that.
Yeah.
Whenever that happens, I'm always going, oh, here we go. So Camille, she's lighter skinned than Isolde.
So that was sort of one of those dynamics I wanted to play with is, you know, the fairer skinned person being the foreigner and the different one and sort of the exoticized one in a lot of ways. Like her clothing does not match the environment at all. She's very guarded. Everything is, you know, long sleeves and boots but they're in a desert. So she's just sweating the entire time that she's there. But that was part of who she was, is that she's, you know, gone on this journey to find a better life for herself. And that sort of adds to her story, adds to the determination of her character and raises the stakes of why she's here and what she has to lose.
Mm-hmm. Now her sword is more of a fencing type of a sword.
Right.
Where Iselda's is much more of like it makes me think of like Arabic.
Yeah. Like that sword. Long scimitar sort of, curved sword. Whereas Camille's is much more like a rapier, much more of a dueling, like, sword, which again reflects the different cultures that they come from, the different styles that they do, and we have some fun with that, both in with the way that they fight and hijinks that ensue later on in the book.
Now it says Camille has a martial discipline when it comes to sword fighting, but almost no sense of swordsmanship or interest in playing to a crowd. Oh, showmanship! Sorry, to a crowd. She has girl pretty thoughts. Her stern composure melts away. Oh, when she has girl pretty thoughts, her stern composure melts away and she reveals herself to be a complete disaster internally. Okay, so these two are going to... I'm just sort of curious because they are so... And the old thing that opposites attract.
Yeah, it was sort of an idea of like... The impetus of the story was, can you convincingly have two people... fall in love during a sword fight, which is a big ask, obviously. it's a big if. But part of that was sort of, figuring out what makes them different and figuring out how they can sort of earn respect for each other in a lot of different ways. Part of that is... But by the time you get to sort of the end of their fight in the first half of the book, you realize that, or they've realized that they have a lot more in common with each other than they do with, you know, the prince they're trying to ostensibly marry. Mm-hmm. And from that, and there's a hint of attraction there. And from that, I remember hearing, from like a YouTube channel who was breaking down sword fighting movie scenes that like sword fighting in general is a very arousing activity, not in like strictly like a sexual sense, but more of just like you have flush skin, you're sweating, you have heavy breathing, and it's not too far of a jump to go from that to like maybe we're catching feelings for each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Prince Damien, and he's described as the heir apparent to the kingdom, and the bachelor, our protagonists, are competing to marry. He's spoiled, arrogant, and cruel, taking pleasure in the attention he's getting from the festivities and the bodies that have been piled up on his behalf. Okay.
Yeah, he's a little psycho.
Okay. So, well, you know, I hate to say it, but royal people sometimes...
Yeah, there's just sort of that disconnect. They've grown up, you know, being told that they're, you know, special and better than people. And more often than not, they take it to heart. And mm-hmm. And Damien was definitely that. There was a lot of discussion, especially early on, whether or not Damien should be, you know, sweet, but like misguided and arrogant and all of that, but ultimately kind of a sweet kid. And so that it would be a harder later on, decisions would be harder. But ultimately, we landed on this interpretation, and I really like it. I think it's the better call.
He's got tattoos, and he wears earrings and stuff like that, which is usually a sign of wealth.
Yeah,
so he's got all those things. Yeah, he's got all those good things going on.
Yeah, a lot of these design choices were Rachel. She's really good at making distinct character choices and making everyone look, you know, very at a glance, like you get a sense of who they are.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other character that's mentioned on the Kickstarter page is the Queen.
Yes.
Who's the previous winner of the Grand Tournament of Ascension. She looks a little older, so it doesn't look like the tournament happens all that often.
No, I mean, it's just whenever someone in the royal family comes of age, so it can be, you know, a couple years apart, depending. More often than not, you know, it's whoever, you know, there are big gaps in between if, you know, someone gets married in and then they have to have a couple kids and then, you know, 17, 18 years later, they, you know, they get their chance finally. Yeah, no, the Queen is a really interesting character because she's a visual representation of, like, this is what our characters stand to become. And there's a lot, I like, the more I think about the Queen and the more, you know, work we've put into her character and what she represents, the more I really like her as sort of a force in the story. Very in the background, but like a very important, figure, both to set the stakes and to sort of, create a contrast.
It says she married the king and gave up her sword arm to hold power across the region. Looks like there's a golden prosthesis.
Part of it is like you've won this sword fight, but that is you've also proven yourself to be an incredibly, you know, dangerous person. So part of the ceremony is that they cut off your arm or cut off part of your arm so that you can't hold a sword anymore.
Why do they do that? You think they'd want somebody, especially if she's a good sword fighter and she wins the tournament, I would think they'd want her to keep her arm so she could defend the royal family if she had to.
Well, she's part of it, so that is, you know, particularly women marry, like, going into royalty tend to be treated more as, you know, vessels to create more royals than people in their own right. So that is, again, it's sort of a dehumanizing aspect. She's very much a person, but it feels like part of her has been lost, both physically and literally, in the sense that she gave up her sword arm to marry into it, and metaphorically in the sense that we never learn what her name is beyond the Queen. She isn't really given a name beyond that.
It says she's soft-spoken, wise, and like Iselda, a cat skin.
Yeah.
That's interesting. There's going to be some stuff about that, I'm sure. She, more than anyone else, understands the draw of power and what you must sacrifice to attain it. So she is basically what Iselda might turn into.
Yeah, particularly. Absolutely.
Yeah, so see. I like the appearance of her. I think that Rachel did a beautiful job on.
Oh, she's brilliant in terms of character design and artistry, and yeah, the sample pages look incredible, and great colorist as well. She colored everything that you're seeing as well, and she just does a really good job balancing her her color and making everything look distinct.
So let's see, Camille is the rose, I take it, because it's the catskin and the rose. So
yes. So Camille, and you can see on the character sheet, is her body is massively scarred up. That's part of the reason why she wears like long, very covering like clothing, is to hide all of that. But she's constantly referred to as being like a foreign beauty. So beautiful face, scarred up body, sort of the imagery of a rose came to mind.
Interesting. Okay, so how long does the tournament go? I mean, is this to the death? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, no, they're ostensibly fighting to the death.
Okay. So, of course, that presents conflict between the two of them.
Right.
Ketsuke and Rose. Now, one thing I should mention, too, is that your project got a Project We Love from Kickstarter.
Indeed.
So that's great.
This is the second time we've gotten it. I'm really excited to say.
Very good. Very good. It looks really interesting. It seems a little different from the other stuff of yours that I've read. So this is more of a romantic adventure thing.
Yeah, which is not something I typically indulge in. I like genre fiction. I like lots of different kinds of genre fiction. But typically, like, you know, my mainstay has been horror and magical realism and, you know, and more literary stuff. And I've always sort of avoided really, like, romance-heavy stories. Mostly just because, you know, as a younger kid, I wasn't really interested in it. But as I've grown up, I always like to challenge myself and do different things with my writing and see, you know, what experiments I can do, and if I can make it work. And part of doing this was saying, okay, what would I do with a romance? Like, if I just did a straight up romance, how would that go? And I'm really proud of it. I'm happy with how it's turning out and the way the script fits together. It's, again, one of the most fun times I've ever had just writing a script. I was compelled to write it. I was, writing for 3 hours in the morning and then going to work and then, like, faking sick to get off early so that I could go back and continue to write the scene that hadn't finished yet. Yeah, that went on for about a week.
Wow. Okay, so that's good. So let's see, it's 68 pages. Any idea when this is going to be ready for people to receive if they've donated?
Well, we are being really conservative with our timelines, because, like, I've never, delivered anything this large all at once. And I want to give Rachel plenty of time, that she needs to make it right. So I believe the estimate says it'll be, like June or July of next year. I'm fairly confident we can get it out before then, but I definitely don't want to over, like, promise and say, you know, it'll be out in January. It's like, I don't know for sure.
Well, if I can say, I would recommend January because that's in time for Valentine's Day, which would be an ideal time for this to
sure
a gift giving for that.
Yeah, no, I wanted to lean into that aspect of it. We would love to have it done as quickly as possible, but ultimately we also want to leave space for, you know, making sure that we're, you know, able to deal with life stuff. And again, not over promising. We tend to keep in really tight communication with our backers and let people know, hey, it just went off to get colored, or it's getting lettered, or this many pages are done. People who back will be able to keep tabs on all of our movements and get an idea of when it's coming rather than just randomly getting in the mail one day.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, let me say that this project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Thursday, August 10 at 12 noon Eastern Daylight Time. I would highly recommend don't wait until August 10 to do it, because as we're talking, you're right on the cusp of getting your goal.
Yep.
And it would be nice to
killer stretch goals too. That I'm really excited, including some extra mini comics and enamel pins and just interesting stuff that we can add on as goodies.
Because a lot of times people who have Kickstarters going are forever refreshing.
Oh, God knows. Yeah. That's, I have to tear myself away a lot of time to just keep from, okay, did anyone else back?
Because if you refresh and nobody has bid, you think, oh, no, it's done. Nobody's ever going to bid.
It's dead. No one's interested in this. We've hit our limit. Yeah, no, no matter what, no matter how often you do this, that is always going through your mind. It's just like, well, we've hit our limit. Like, no one else is ever going to be interested in this again. And you're mostly wrong. Someone always comes along and proves you wrong. But
well, you've got that time sort of in the middle where people sort of figure, well, I got plenty of time.
Yeah, it's hard to convince people. It's easy to convince people at the beginning of the campaign. It's easy to convince people at the end of a campaign. In the middle, people drag their feet. And I can't blame them. That's just life.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's the August 10th, and be sure to get in there so you can save Wells here from refreshing all the time, and you can get into the stretch goals, which he sounds really excited about. So that'd be fun to see have happen.
For sure.
Catskin in the Rose, a graphic novella, and be sure to support it. Let's talk about your other projects and see how they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've talked a little bit about Mechaton. How's that doing?
It's great. We just finished issue 5. That has been released digitally, and it is currently being printed at Comics Wellspring. And will come out to me shortly. Like they sent the preview emails, proof. There we go. Proof copy email, showing, you know, what it's going to look like, a couple of days ago. So I imagine it's being printed now and it should be shipped off to us and come sometime next week. And then we start shipping right away. As soon as I can get away with it, I'll have that out the door.
All right.
Then the, trade of Mechaton, it will be in stores through Scout soon. I don't have a date and I don't want to oversell when it's going to be, but hopefully sometime this year, we'll hopefully see, the trade of Mechaton in stores. And then next year we'll probably see a Kickstarter for Mechaton, whether that's issue 6, whether that's a you know, deluxe version of the trade. I'm not entirely sure. We'll figure that out. But yeah, that's where we're at right now.
Cool. That's good. All right. How about, I guess if somebody wants to find out what Mechaton is about, do you want to real quickly say what it is?
For sure. Mechaton is a sci-fi action comedy about a glove that crash lands on Earth. The two idiots that find it and discover that anything they punch while wearing it turns into a battle mech, and the kaiju shenanigans that ensue. It's about community and family and punching stuff with a big robot made out of garbage. So I definitely recommend. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And 180 degrees the other direction is Frankenstein the Unconquered. Talk about that one, if you would.
Absolutely. That's our hard R-rated action horror piece about Frankenstein's monster thawing from the ice after 200 years of being frozen to discover a bombed out post-apocalypse that is broken and hideous, just like he is. So he attempts to live a normal life there. It doesn't work out very well. Now he wakes up every day and chooses violence. It is very Conan the Barbarian with, Halloween monsters. It's our love letter to Universal Horror and sort of the monster movies of our childhood. And it's just a lot of fun. It's very, you know, 80s Terminator 2 style action. So.
Mm-hmm. And how's that doing? What's the latest on that?
Yeah, we released Frankenstein number 2 into the wild earlier this year, and Frankenstein number 3 and number 4 we are packaging together in our next Kickstarter. Hopefully at the end of August is when we'll be releasing that one. If not, definitely beginning of September. But that is, I just got the sample pages from our artist, and they look killer. I am extremely excited to show off what we have for that.
Cool. Now, of course, if people want to keep up with you on the internet, how do they do that?
The easiest way, honestly, now is to sign up for my newsletter, Comics, Cats, and Cocktails, where we talk about all of those things. It's on Substack. It goes out, the full newsletter goes out once a month with small updates, kind of whenever they're relevant. In terms of social media, I am on Twitter for as long as it is a viable place to be, at Wells Thomp, Thomp, just my last name with the last three letters cut off. And then the same at Blue Sky, at Wells Thomp. So if you're on, there, you can find me as well. Yeah, Twitter is becoming more and more hostile, unfortunately, to comic creators. So whether or not I can stay there long term is a big question. But for the time being, that's where you can find me.
Okay, you're on Blue Sky too. I have to get an invite to go to Blue Sky.
And yeah, which does make it is a lovely place for that reason. But
because I've asked for an invite and they have not responded yet, so. I'm on the outside looking in when it comes to Blue Sky. So at least you're on there. That's an important thing to get the word about that. You going out to conventions at all this year, or are you waiting? You know,
this year we have not been able to find a way. Both me and Dalton have made some pretty significant moves cross country. So it's been increasingly difficult to get out there, but we're really looking forward next year. We want to, you know, I live in Chicago, so I'll be going to C2E2, hopefully with a booth. And we're looking forward to doing more and more of those kinds of shows. We would love to be at Arkansas Comic Con this year. So far, right now we're on the wait list. That is, you know, that's my home state. I love going there every year. It's one of our best shows for sure. And more we've been doing signings at comic shops. So keep an eye out on social media, on you know, newsletter stuff. And we will be sure to update you when we're at a comic shop near you.
Okay. You have a website too, right?
Absolutely. My name, WellsThompson.com. And that gives you links to all of my books and what I'm working on right now and my newsletter and a way to contact me directly if you want to get in touch, hire me for editing or writing or whatever the case may be.
Okay, sounds good. Much success on all these good things, Wells, and we look forward to talking with you again in the future. And I'm sure this is going to, by the time this posts, you will be into the extra levels,
yeah, and doing all kinds of good things. Refreshing the page right now, it looks like we're at 9625 with 221 backers. So,
oh, wow.
Less than $400 to the end there.
All right. Well, I'm sure you could still use another $400 no matter where you are in the thing. So if you want to get out and support this, be sure to go to Kickstarter and look for it, because it's The Catskin and the Rose, a graphic novella, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. I'm looking forward to being able to read it too. So great stuff. I always enjoy your writing and everything that you're doing. So keep it up and lots of success, Wells.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that, Wayne. Always a pleasure to be on, and can't wait to come back.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.